All right, on this episode of Bouts Talking Bouts, happy to be talking to a UFC veteran, also a pioneer of MMA in Australia overall, has competed at both light heavyweight as well as heavyweight. I'm talking to Anthony Parrish. How's your day going so far there, Anthony?
Sorry, how's my... Sorry, what was the question?
Oh, I was just wondering how your day was going so far.
Oh, yeah, good. It's midnight now, Wednesday nights. Had a full day of teaching in the morning, teaching at night, so it was a good day.
Yeah, and I'd seen, like, obviously a while back at this point, but as, you know, it's affected other people too, the whole COVID-19 thing. Has Team Parrish Mixed Martial Arts managed to adapt and kind of, you know, get things going in a different way with the backdrop of the pandemic? Like, you just talk about coming off of training there. Like, what adjustments were kind of made with all that there?
Thankfully, you know, Australia seems to be doing a lot better than some other countries. We did shut down completely last year for 3 months between March and June. And then at the end of June, we were able to reopen and with restrictions. But pretty much since then, it's been going 100%, 100 miles an hour. Like, you know, we're breaking records in terms of people signing up and training and wanting to stay. I think, you know, the 3 months off really fired up a few people. So, yeah, we're pretty fortunate over here at the moment.
Well, that's good to hear that it could function to put certain things in perspective for some people. And now that you say that, actually, I was speaking to Janae Harding ahead of her last Bellator fight, and I think she said there was, like, 2 cases in the state altogether. So great to hear you guys are doing all right.
Yeah, look, you know, at the moment we're having a bit of a... For a month there or two, we didn't have a single case in the whole of Australia, let alone the state. But now the last couple of weeks, you know, there's a few hot spots appearing here and there, and everyone's getting worried, and politicians are getting worried and shutting down borders again. But I think we'll get through it like we did before.
Yeah, for sure. I think there will be, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel there for sure. But I'm kind of wondering when. Yeah, for sure. But I'm kind of wondering when the path initially started kind of guiding towards MMA here. Like, I was seeing you had some fights there towards the end of 2003 there from what looks to be a one-night tournament there. So what was that first foray out there into competition like?
Well, that was my MMA debut. I think it was like the last 8-man tournament in one night that was happening in Australia. So I thought, no, I'll give it a go. And it was in a boxing ring, it wasn't in a cage. And, you know, it was my debut, and I had 3 matches in one night. I won all 3.
Had there been, like, a prior instance of, like, seeing mixed martial arts beyond that, like, say, like, a UFC or Pride or something like that? Or was it more a factor of you were a martial artist, there was this local competition going on, and you're like, hey, I'll take part in this? Like, was there an awareness of UFC and Pride?
About 1995 was like my first intro to BJJ, and much like many other people, you know, we only about a year before that, you know, was the first UFC. So you know, back then it was just VHS tapes. There's a few VH tapes, you know, lying people had, you know, the UFC and different cage fighting shows, and you know, I was a martial artist. That's what got me into BJJ. And, you know, I was always a BJJ competitor first. And I guess for me, you know, being a competitor, I wanted to, you know, test my skills in the MMA arena. So it was kind of like a natural progression.
Yeah, and the record here showing you won the first 3 fights straight there as part of that, you know, one-night tournament there. What was the methodology like taking part in something like one of those one-night tournaments? Because like you said, it kind of had gotten phased out more so after the fact. Like, what's it like taking part in something like that? I wager the methodology is a lot different, fighting 3 times in one night as compared to 1.
Well, look, you can only take one match at a time. I remember quite vividly, just had to take one match at a time. And you know, with my style of fighting, I like to you know, close the gap quickly and put them against the ropes or cage and, you know, grind them down to the ground. So you just have to take one match at a time. And fortunate enough for me, you know, each match I was up to win in the first round. So it was almost at the end of the night after my three matches, it was like having the one three-round fight.
Yeah, and then just some fights after that, obviously, over the Australian circuit, Shooto Australia and some other circuits there. But then I'm seeing you get the call-up for the UFC debut there, and you're fighting a pretty established name there in Jeff Munson in the heavyweight ranks. Like, what are your recollections of, like, when the offer was initially put out to you and just the general timeline leading to the UFC debut?
Oh, look, when the UFC calls you, you know, you're not going to say no. I realize, you know, in hindsight, I probably wasn't ready for it yet because, you know, I only had five or six MMA matches up until then. And looking back, I was in the wrong division too. Like, I'm a natural light heavyweight. I mean, I was just a bit lazy back then. But you know, a heavyweight match appeared. Like, Joe Silver says, I've got a heavyweight match against Jeff Munson. Do you want it? I went, yeah, of course. Book me in.
Yeah, when was that point you realized that light heavyweight would probably be your most ideal division? Because even that tournament we were talking about was a heavyweight foray as well. Like, when did you realize that, I guess, light heavyweight would be the optimal weight class for you?
Yeah, even that tournament was like a modified heavyweight. That 8-man tournament I debuted in was under 100 kilos or under 220 pounds, as opposed to, you know, the heavyweight now, which is 265 or, you know, 120 kilos. But pretty much after I had two UFC matches as a heavyweight in 2006, and I lost both of those. And, you know, after that, I pretty much said, told myself, no, I'm too small for these heavyweights. I'm going down.
You got to be on some big cards pretty early on, though. I mean, in that initial UFC foray there, like, I mean, UFC 61, the Bitter Rivals card there that was a stacked card. And then also UFC 66, the Liddell versus Ortiz rematch there that obviously garnered a lot of pay-per-view buys. So, I mean, was there still some benefit being part of those events just in terms of, like, I guess the spectacle?
And yeah, of course. Yeah, I have no regrets whatsoever. Like, you know, I learned very, very fortunate for the opportunity back then, and, you know, I'm proud to be a part of those cards.
Yeah, because I imagine being part of something like Liddell versus Ortiz was quite exciting just because of the unprecedented nature of it almost. Like, it seemed like there was such a spotlight on it that had not been on the sport prior to that point, at least on that level of domestic attention, I guess. So that must have been a cool thing to be a part of, get caught up in the hoopla and everything.
Yes, it was a very cool, because, you know, I when Zuffa took over UFC, I think it was like UFC 30 or 32, you know, I followed, you know, watched all the UFCs in the numbered 30s and the 40s and the 50s. So I was, you know, I was following the career of, you know, Tito Ortiz and Chuck Liddell. And so, yeah, I was looking forward to their matchup.
Yeah, and then after that, you endeavor to go on, like, a different kind of circuit there, like the cage fighting championship circuit, and then Rise MMA Australia also, from what I was seeing. Like, what did you learn during that Sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, well, after, you know, after my two UFC losses, you know, I got released from UFC, so it's like, you know, back to the drawing board. So I knew I wanted to get back into the UFC again. But this time as a light heavyweight. So, you know, I went back to the local circuit and fought on a local circuit, you know, had match after match, and win after win, and, you know, until I got my shot back in the UFC.
Yeah, and how did you feel you'd grown it, like, as compared to, like, the previous UFC run versus where you were at during the second run? Because I imagine there was a lot of growth between those two periods there.
Oh, absolutely. Like, just in the way we train too, you know, I had to with the second UFC, my second UFC run, you know, had a striking coach, a wrestling coach, a BJJ coach, and then an overall MMA coach. Plus, you know, worked on the strength and conditioning and nutrition, and you know, had the whole package. So I was more than ready for my second run.
Yeah, and it seemed like the experience was the biggest factor, as you alluded to, because during that initial UFC run, you'd only had a few fights to your credit, but the second UFC run, it's like now you're a grounded, established martial artist, so I imagine the experience paid dividends.
Oh, absolutely. The experience in doing the you know, the full training camps, and then the weight cut, and then, you know, rehydrating, and then, you know, preparing for the fights, and yeah, invaluable experience.
And I understand there was a bit of a backstory to the UFC return. Like, I think Joe Silva was kind of sizing you up in the hotel lobby, and he's like, hey, do you want to fight Mirko Krokop? Like, what are your recollections of all of that there?
Yeah, well, it was, I remember, like, it was yesterday as well. Krokop, he was actually using my gym the week of the fight, so he was coming every day into my gym and, you know, using my facilities and training with his coaches. And then all of a sudden, 2 days, so I became friends with him. And then 2 days before the fight, Joe Silva comes up and looking up and down, and he says, "What do you weigh?" I go, "Oh, about 220." He goes, "You want to fight?" I went, "Sure." And I thought I was going to replace Elvis Sinisic, because he just pulled out of his fight against Chris Haseman, which is a light heavyweight match. So I thought I was going to jump in and into that match. And then Joe Silva just all of a sudden pulls out, "Oh, do you want to fight Krokop?" And I looked at him and I go, "No." And I actually said no. And then he goes, "Okay." And then about an hour later, I'm just thinking to myself, I'm going, what did I just do? I just turned down fighting one of the biggest names in MMA in front of my home crowd on the first UFC card in Australia. So I called him back, Joe Silva, and I said, "No, I want to do it." He goes, "What made you change your mind?" And, you know, I just told him all those things. He goes, "Great, let's book it."
Yeah, and then just like the actual fight itself, I mean, just what an experience that was. Like, I remember that pretty vividly. Like, and it seemed like you got on people's radars in a way, even despite the outcome not, you know, being in your favor per se. But I think you showed a lot of valor in that particular fight, especially stepping up short notice. Do you think that fight was like a big, like, I guess, game changer for you in a lot of ways, despite maybe not getting the desired result there?
Yeah. After that fight, or during that fight first, you know, even, you know, I was, you know, keeping my distance. You know, I wasn't, you know, playing my striking game, and I was able to get close and put him against the cage. I actually grabbed like a single leg, going for a single leg takedown. But I think I remember in my head, I was already celebrating too early. You know, thinking that I'm going to get him to the ground soon, but unfortunately, it didn't happen. I should have kept going with that takedown until I actually had him on the ground. But yeah, I learned a lot from that fight. And then after that fight, you know, Joe Silva gave me a four-fight contract with the UFC, and with my next match being as a light heavyweight.
Yeah, and then in that next match, I mean, just what a performance that was, too. I mean, getting the first UFC victory over Tom Blackledge there, first round rear naked choke. You're on a big card out there in Sydney, Australia. Just all factors considered, what was that moment like for you, man?
Oh, look, that was probably my number one highlight, the very first UFC win. And like you said, I did it in front of my home crowd with a rear naked choke. I couldn't have asked, you know, I couldn't have written a better finish for my first win.
Yeah, and then you went on a bit of a streak after that there. Like, you had that fight with Cyril Diabate that I remember I was quite intrigued by leading into it. Just, I thought it was like a fun stylistic matchup, and yeah, just the fight ended up playing out in an entertaining way. What do you remember about fighting Diabate, just fighting this real rangy, like lanky kind of striker there?
Yeah, well, at the time I fought him, he was actually ranked number one in the UFC as the most accurate striker. So you know, my boxing coach at the start of the training camp, he goes, "Anthony, are you ready to run a marathon?" So we really worked a lot on footwork during that match and during that training camp, and just want to, you know, stay out of his range and just keep moving, like not stand still, because he's like a sniper where he doesn't throw many strikes. He's very, the ones he strikes, he connects. And he connects the most if you're standing still. So we made sure that I kept moving, and then I was able to time a couple of takedowns off his body kicks and take him down, and you know, use my ground pound and finish with a rear naked choke as well.
Yeah, great second round finish there in that one, and then you have the Nick Penner fight shortly thereafter, and you're just putting together that streak now at this juncture. But I'm kind of wondering if there's a bit of a unique feeling with the Penner fight, in as far as like you're getting the finish via strikes now. Like, obviously I imagine you're excited getting these submission finishes because of your, you know, great jiu-jitsu resume, and that's what initially got you into MMA competition. But is there like a certain confidence you get from like a TKO victory? Does that galvanize your striking efforts at all? Is there a unique sort of dynamic with getting a finish like that?
Yes, but I guess with that TKO victory, it wasn't from stand up strikes. Like, I still, you know, I used my strikes to take him down, and I got to the mount position. Yeah. And I was striking him from mount, and then that's when the referee stopped it from there.
Yeah, I guess some of your later victories, which I'll shortly be getting to, I guess that would be more of an instance of the striking confidence being emboldened there. But yeah, another victory on home soil there in the Penner fight there. So I imagine that must have felt great. It seems like you got a few chances to compete on home soil with UFC. I imagine that was quite important to you.
Well, at the time of those couple of UFCs, there weren't that many Australians in the UFC. Like, pretty much it was three or four of us. Whereas now there's almost like 30 Australian, New Zealand fighters in the UFC at the moment, whereas back then there's only like three or four, maybe five. So they wanted to, every time they had a show in Australia, they wanted to make sure Australians were on it. So I guess that was one of the reasons I was lucky enough to fight and also win in front of my home crowd.
Yeah, and just a bit of a sidebar from your competitive career, just because you mentioned it there. Like, how cool is it to see this new influx of Australian talent, not even just on a level of fighters, but I mean, like, media with, like, you know, Submission Radio, they're putting out great stuff. Robert Whittaker becoming the first Australian to hold a UFC belt. I mean, you've got Megan Anderson coming up in that featherweight title fight. Like, how cool is it to kind of see this new influx of Australian talent and then also realize you laid the groundwork for that?
Oh, it's amazing. And we've got, you know, we've got Alex Volkanovski as well.
Absolutely.
And you know, just across the road in New Zealand, you know, Israel Adesanya. So it's Australian, New Zealand fighters, we're you know, fighters to be reckoned with. There's a huge MMA circuit, a local circuit, which, you know, there's a lot of fighters, a lot of academies, and, you know, they all have a goal of not only making it to the UFC, but, you know, becoming UFC world champion as well. So it's really, really a good time, a good place to be if you like MMA and want to be an MMA champion, you know, here in Australia.
Yeah, it's a vibrant scene, and it's cool to see that for sure, man. But then, just going back to the competitive career here, I mean, you have a pair of bouts that I imagine are pretty interesting in a sense, like just diametrically opposed outcomes in a lot of ways. I mean, you end up having two fights that are 21 seconds combined. Like, obviously there was that Ryan Jimmo fight there where you end up on the losing end of a KO punch at the 7 second mark. But then in the very next outing, a KO victory over Vinny Magalash at UFC 163 and got the knockout of the night distinction in 14 seconds there. What was that pocket of your career like? Because like I said, diametrically opposed outcomes. I imagine a myriad of emotions through that stretch there. What was that like there? Just two fights, 21 seconds altogether.
Well, that's probably like a record in itself somewhere along the line. Like two matches back to back is 21 seconds. But, and you know, one win, one loss. But yeah, it was like we were chatting, you know, I had three wins in a row and I was probably a little bit too overconfident going into that match with Ryan, and then just, you know, you just got to be first. Got to be fast. And you know, I wasn't. And, you know, he was. And then that, you know, it was tough. It was, you know, and fighters are after that match. You know, fighters are only as good as their last match. So you know, I had to wait almost a year, maybe a little bit more, to get my redemption. And it just so happened to be, you know, I was fighting Vinny against who's a BJJ world champion, and he's like in his mid-20s, and I was 40 at the time, and he says there was no way I was going to lose to a 40-year-old. I was going to, you know, I'll retire if I lose, and it was just giving me more motivation. And you know, I didn't want to. One, I wanted to, you know, redeem myself from my last loss, and two, I wasn't going to let this, you know, young upstart, you know, get the better of me. So I was pumped, I was motivated. Never trained as hard as I did for the Vinny fight, and you know, I got the result.
Yeah, and that was a curious one because I think a lot of people figured that fight would take place in the grappling just because of your guys' jiu-jitsu acumens there. But 14-second KO, I mean, it just kind of shows the beauty of MMA in as far as, like, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, you know, my strongest weapon in striking is just my straight right cross, and that's what I nailed Vinny with. So, and that's what dropped him, and he was dazed. So I just finished it off with the ground and pound in the guard.
Yeah, and that was a stellar victory. I remember that was a very electric one. I remember watching that one live for sure. But I kind of touched on the jiu-jitsu accolades and stuff like that, and I really like jiu-jitsu in as far as like how oriented it is to just the lineage of everything. Like, it seems like that's an important thing, and like Carlos Machado kind of showing you the ropes and stuff like that and whatnot. Like, how cool is it to kind of like carry on the legacy and then be part of that lineage, like carry it on to the, you know, next step and everything like that, and just to be part of a martial arts tradition like that?
I love it. You know, that's one of the reasons I've loved martial arts is the tradition and the lineage and the loyalty. And you know, I lead by example, and you know, I've been with Carlos now for almost 25 years, and you know, I've got him, you know, got his photo on my wall, you know, along with the other founders, you know, from the founder of BJJ, and I pass that on to my students. So you know, I really want to pass on everything to my students, and you know, I want them to be 10 times better than me. You know, I hope they become, you know, multiple world champion in BJJ and you know, win a lot more UFC fights than I did and become UFC champion as well.
Yeah, and I always loved the nickname that came from the jiu-jitsu game you have too, just the hippo and everything like that. Do you remember who, like, the originator of the hippo nickname was? Because I always thought that was one of the better fighter nicknames.
No, it just happened when... you know, early on when I was training, like, I always had, my goal back then, even today, and still is today, is, you know, get on top, stay on top, and finish from on top. So back then, even back then, I had a very top game and heavy game and pressure game. And every time I get on someone, you know, they can't get me off. So people just started saying, get off me, you big hippo. And I kind of stuck from there.
Yeah, definitely always enjoyed that nickname for sure. And yeah, I mean, great top game for sure. I can only imagine how stifling that would feel to be on the bottom there. But I mean, just talking about some of the fights you have here, like the Guto in Assange fight was a fight that ended up being the last victory of the UFC run you had there, and another first round victory, rear naked choke, getting it done in Sydney, Australia again. I'm sure you don't have the realization at the time of it being like such a significant moment, but just kind of looking back on that fight and all those factors I just outlined there, like what did that particular bout mean to you, just being part of that Rockhold versus Bisping card there?
I felt that was like one of my best performance to date. I was really happy with how I did that, and that was actually the first match I had after training at Jackson Winklejohn. So I was really happy that I got the results for them as well. But yeah, I was really happy with everything. Everything just came together: my striking, the wrestling, the grappling, and he was, you know, he was a good opponent as well. So I was really happy with that match.
Yeah, that was a quality.
And on top of that, you know, getting it done in front of a home crowd was sort of like just a extra bonus.
Yeah, I imagine that's something you've never fully like get adjusted to or get jaded to, and we're like, oh, another victory in Sydney. Like, I mean, imagine that's like a mounting sense of enthusiasm, just like adding to an ever-growing story, just like a new chapter to the book kind of thing.
Yeah, it's great because obviously everyone knows you in Sydney, and you get the biggest cheer, you know, especially when you win. So it was a great feeling.
And to that point, like just with the fighters nowadays competing to no fans, like what do you think that would be like, just hypothetically? Like, would that be a strange dynamic for you if you were, say, actively competing now and there's this no fans in attendance kind of dynamic?
Not really, because my coaches always say to me, and I pass the same message on to my students, it doesn't matter who's out there, it doesn't matter if there's 25 people watching or 25,000. It shouldn't actually matter. So you just go in there and do your job. And a lot of the fights I had in Australia on the local scene, there wasn't that many people there. Maybe like 200-300 for a couple of fights, and half of them were fighters and the corner people of the other fights that were on the card. So. I fought on small cards before. If I was fighting today in the UFC, I don't think it would be a problem with fighting in an empty arena.
Yeah, you fought to such varying scales of event size over the career. I mean, even the last fight here, like the UFC 193 fight, just that record-breaking Rousey versus Holm fight there, and another domestic one for you there.
Yes. That was my last match. I knew it was going to be my last match. Probably even the match before, I probably even should have retired. But because I had in my head that it was just getting a bit harder and harder to do the training camps. Because at that time I was 43, I think, for the UFC 193. But I wanted to be a part of it because they were talking about going to Melbourne for so long, and there's going to be a record crowd, so I want to be a part of it. Unfortunately, I didn't get the result in that one.
Yeah, I mean, still a monumental event to be a part of. I mean, maybe similar to the Liddell versus Ortiz 2 card, where it's like a big event, but not necessarily the individual outcome kind of thing, like similar dynamic maybe.
Yep. I mean, don't get me wrong, I would have liked to have won, because I told myself before the match I was going to retire, win, lose or draw, but just just didn't happen on the day.
It seemed like you were very appreciative of all the people that helped you towards the end, though. Like, I think I saw you shouted out Paul Dallow for helping you with sponsorship and everything throughout all of your UFC fights there. So it seems like you're an appreciative guy, like recognizing the people that brought you to the dance kind of thing.
Absolutely. Like, you're only as strong as the people around you. And I always made it a point to have good coaches and managers and people to help me. And, And I'm very thankful. I don't take anyone for granted. And, you know, I want to make sure that I thanked everyone. And even today, they're still all a part of my life today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to ask this next question just as more of a curiosity-minded thing, because I've seen Submission Underground has gotten a few events going on now, and I've seen certain retired MMA fighters popping up there, just some notable names on the submission grappling circuit in general in recent years, even beyond that promotional bubble there. Is that something you'd be interested in, just considering your lengthy list of jiu-jitsu accolades, or is it mostly just focus on the academy and focus on training more so?
No. Back in 2018, I went back after a long layoff. I went back to competing.
Oh, cool.
And I competed in the Australian BJJ Championships, and I won. And then I went to Vegas that year in 2018 in the World Masters. And I competed in Masters 4 division, which is 46 to 50-year-olds. And I won a gold medal, like six matches, and won the open division in the World Championships in 2018. I went back in 2019, but I fell short one. I won silver medal. And I was going to go last year again, but obviously everything was shut down last year with COVID. And, if all goes well, I'll compete again this year.
Well, that's awesome. I love hearing that. It's great that you're out there competing again. And just, yeah, like I said, great jiu-jitsu accolades. So it's cool that you're out there. And clearly the results are in your favor. So that's awesome. But usually when I have fighters on as well, I ask if there's like particular genres of music they like to train to, like if there's different artists they generally gravitate towards. It seems like you're into the hard rock there. Like you came up to Kickstart My Heart by Motley Crue for a few of those fights, and I think you'd been to a Guns N' Roses concert a while back too. So like, is that kind of the general vibe in the gym, like when you get the aux cord? Are you kind of fine with whoever puts on what? Like, what's the music that's generally bumped at the academy there?
Look, if it was up to me, it'd be all like rock and roll, hard rock and heavy metal, but not everyone likes that kind of music these days, so I have to mix it up a little bit. But yeah, definitely the hair bands, like Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses and Def Leppard, are definitely a favorite. But I like also the old school thrash metal, like Metallica and Megadeth and those bands as well. And just good old-fashioned rock and roll bands, too.
No, that's all up my alley, man. You're speaking my language. Megadeth was the first concert I went to. Yeah, definitely some good shit. Gets me fired up, no doubt. But you've been really good with your time, man, and I want to be mindful of the fact that it's a bit later on your end than it is for me. I mean, I could talk to you all day, just considering the experiences you've had and stuff like that, but
I usually, by the time I leave the gym and have some dinner, shower, and wind down a little bit, I usually get to bed around 1 anyway. So, it's been good chatting.
Yeah, I appreciate you making the time and just a lot of great insights on what was a great career overall, man. So, really appreciate you making some time and just coming on the show and everything. And yeah, just, you enjoy the rest of your night, man. Best of luck with everything going forward. And as far as like competing again with the submission grappling, and yeah, just you have a good rest of your night.
Thank you very much. And thanks for giving me the chance to chat.